A Syrian superhero today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. The story of a mother from a besieged town in Syria comes to life in a digital comic book.
She loves Spider-Man, so she couldn't believe that the people behind Spider-Man knew who she was, were interested in her story, and wanted to give her the same treatment they gave to Spider-Man.
Also, a farmer's response to those who say that immigrants take American jobs.
This idea, particularly in agriculture, of these folks are coming taking American jobs in agriculture, that's horse feathers.
Plus, the American who became the coffee king of Russia.
When I was telling normal Russians, I go, would you like to have a great cappuccino? I don't even know what a cappuccino is, you know? And so it was just amazing.
That's all coming up today here on The World. Thanks for being with us. We start today's show with a story that we have focused on a lot, Syria. And when the war there went into year three, then four, and it's well now into its fifth year, I began asking myself a simple question. Why can't it be stopped? We hear now that by the end of this year, the eastern part of the city of Aleppo could be totally destroyed. So why is Syria such a tough nut to crack? Max Fisher has given this question a lot of thought. He writes and edits the Interpreter column in the New York Times. The rebels appear to be losing their hold on eastern Aleppo, Max. It's one of their last remaining urban strongholds. Some wars end when one side simply loses. Could that happen in Syria?
So Syria is a really unusual case because the number of outside foreign interventions has just suspended the usual laws of nature there. Things that normally would lead one or both sides to exhaust by this point, or maybe even long before this point, just aren't present. They can keep fighting as long as the guns keep flowing, and there's no reason to believe that the outside actors will ever stop funding their respective sides.
Yeah, just go down quickly the list of outside actors. Remind us who they are.
Oh, man. On the pro-regime side, Iran is the really big actor, as well as the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah, which is sponsored by Iran. And then, of course, you have Russia has played a really significant role in terms of air power. On the pro-rebel side, you have the Gulf states, such as Saudi Arabia, providing a lot of funding and arms, not because they're so concerned about promoting democracy in Syria, but because they want to oppose Iran. And you also have the United States. It's weird. Our debate in America acts as if we have not intervened in this war, but we are a really, really important actor. We provide a lot of weapons to the rebels. And then you also have Turkey that is also sponsoring the rebel groups. And then making it even more complicated, there are Kurdish groups that are on neither side, and those are funded very heavily as well by the United States. So all of these different actors are pulling the war in different directions. And because they don't really face any meaningful costs for it, at least not relative to their investment, they see very little reason to ever de-escalate or compromise in this war. So what you see is all of these outside actors just keep pushing against one another. No one is strong enough to push anyone else over, but everyone is strong enough to keep the war going. And we're all just fighting this down to the last Syrian.
How do the different sides in the Syrian civil war keep going? I mean, at some point they must get exhausted, right?
Well, they really don't, because the thing to remember is Syria is a really small country, and it's a pretty poor country, but the countries that are involved on the outside are much larger. You know, Russia is not going to run out of bombs. It could fight this war for 100 years. So this is the question that you face in any plan from Clinton or Trump or anyone else in how to end the war, get people to stop fighting, is how do you impose costs on these outside actors such that the war will become too painful for them to continue? And we just haven't figured out a way to do that. Any cost that we can impose on Russia, we're already imposing. We're already sanctioning them. You know, anything in terms of strikes, whether it's cruise missiles, dropping some bombs, maybe we arm the rebels some more, that's just going to be an incremental escalation of the war in a way that everybody's going to be able to continue fighting. Any bid that we can make in terms of escalation, the Russians and the Iranians can match without breaking a sweat. We send in more cruise missiles, they can start dropping more bombs. And the only effect will be that the war is going to be deadlier and kill more people without actually changing that underlying calculus. The only way we could outbid Russia is by doing something that they cannot do. They have a million-person military, so in order to exceed their capacity, that would mean a full American invasion and occupation, and I think for a lot of very good reasons, that is just not going to happen.
Let me ask you this. We taxpayers count on policymakers to come up with solutions to difficult, intractable problems like Syria. What do you think accounts for this failure of political creativity?
I think that American power is limited. This is a taboo in America that we don't like to talk about, don't like to acknowledge. But if you look at the last 15 years of American foreign policy, it's a lesson that we've learned again and again, where we think that there is some intractable, faraway problem, very complex, that we can go in and solve if we just use enough muscle and enough military force, and it never works. And it continues to not work, but we can't acknowledge that because we have this idea built into our mythology that we are such a powerful country and that our power is so fundamentally moral and values driven that we really can fix anything. So what you're going to see for the next however long this conflict lasts is politicians promising that they have the answer, they know how to lead us through it, and then the war is just going to keep going.
Max Fisher, editor of the Interpreter column with the New York Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
When we hear about the devastation in Syria, almost always it's about Aleppo. Granted, the destruction in Syria's largest city is on a massive scale, but there are other places in Syria where residents are suffering through terrible conditions, like the small mountain town of Madaya near the Lebanese border. You may recall the headlines last year about Madaya. People there were found to be starving, eating boiled grass after they had killed all the cats in town. And residents often can't get help either because the town's basically cut off from the outside world.
It's a town that's very beautiful, very lush, very green. And unfortunately, it's found itself in a very strategic corridor. It's a supply line, if you will.
That's Reem Momtaz, a producer for ABC News. This spring, the network tried to get a team of reporters into Madaya, but failed. So Momtaz began an extended text conversation in Arabic with one mother in Madaya.
I was having day-long conversations with this woman. She would text me from the moment she woke up, which was very, very early, like 5 a.m., and then she would text me truly throughout the day. It became sort of a stream of consciousness situation. And one day she told me, you know, it's funny, I speak to you like I speak to my best friend. It's like you're my confidant. It's a really bizarre situation to find yourself in as a journalist.
Right.
And obviously we couldn't go to her. We couldn't interview her. We couldn't even get her to do a Skype interview, which is what journalists around the world have resorted to and reverted to since the beginning of this conflict. The internet is so curtailed there that even that was not possible. So we started texting and we decided, all right, we're just going to use this as a daily diary. So she started telling us about her daily life. And then we started thinking, well, we need to visualize this. We are a television station.
Mm.
And it was just impossible.
So who was she exactly?
She is a mother who lives in that town, who is born and raised there, who has five children, and who was willing to take the risk to speak to foreign journalists because there was a real risk, and there continues to be a real risk with her speaking to us, which is why we haven't revealed her identity. People in the town feel that if those who are besieging them, i.e. the president's forces, Hezbollah and other armed factions, if they know who is helping people understand what's going on inside this besieged town, then these people will be targeted. And that has been said to us from various different people in the town, medics, other people who work with NGOs. They have been targeted. They are now on lists. They can't leave. They can't go in. They can't go out. We basically wanted to tell the story of a normal person in the town, a civilian.
Right.
Not someone who's an activist, not someone who is a fighter, even though, I mean, let's be clear, people who are besieged for a year, everyone sort of becomes part of a kind of struggle in the end.
How did you know and how do you know today that Madaya mom is who she says she is, just a normal mom in Madaya?
She sent us her IDs. So we have official documents of who she is, and we've been able to cross-check the authenticity of these documents. So that we know. She was able to send us a few stills that she took from around where she says her home is, and we've been able to verify that those pictures indeed correspond to other landscapes that we've seen in that town. Now, in the end, of course, in Syria, you know, I haven't been to Madaya now since the conflict has started, and I haven't met her. So that's always been the problem, right? But it is a siege situation, which means by definition, that's the issue.
ABC now has this idea to tell the story of Madaya through the eyes of this mother in illustrated comic book form. What was the basis for the images? I mean, how did you kind of logistically go about this?
People at Marvel are just some of the most talented people I've ever worked with.
Marvel Comics, I mean, they do the superheroes and that kind of thing.
Exactly. And they understood the story in a way that I, frankly, didn't really anticipate. They made sure that the artist that they commissioned was someone who had gone through a similar conflict himself.
Right.
Dalibor Teladic is someone who went through the Yugoslav War. He was 18 when the war broke out. And so he had this sensitivity that I think someone who hasn't necessarily gone through a similar kind of war where there were sieges, where there was extremely ferocious bombing, wouldn't necessarily be able to do the same way.
I got to say, it really works, these illustrations. I mean, comics are a very powerful medium for this story. Tell us about the scene where the girls go back to a reopened school in Madaya, but the next day a shell falls on the school building. One girl sees her friend blown apart. They're just hysterical. What happens next in that whole world of that girl?
So they run home, completely petrified. They run home to the security and safety of their mother. They recount what they saw. They tell her that they had to walk through puddles of blood that came from their friends, that they saw their teacher hurt, and that they barely escaped. And then she proceeds to tell me that she spent hours trying to comfort them, but really at a loss as to how she was supposed to do that, because it's not like she could tell them, don't worry, this is going to stop. We know when the war is going to end. She herself constantly asks me, when is this going to stop? When is the siege going to be lifted? When are we going to become free again? So she finds herself in this position where she's trying to be the mother that every child in that position needs in that moment, while at the same time feeling extremely helpless.
So you were really lucky with kind of the subject you got for this. I mean, somebody who was really willing to engage.
Well, I think she is truly extraordinary, and we talk about that in the context of a Marvel comic. Obviously, Marvel comics are all built around heroes and superheroes. And in a way, she is. She's an extraordinary person. People who aren't necessarily interested in Syria or aren't necessarily following Syria every day because, frankly, they can't take seeing more bloody children every day, have said to us, I can totally identify with her, and I feel for her in a way that I haven't felt with other stories on Syria.
I know you're still in touch with Madaya Mom. Do you know if she's read the comic?
Just one screen grab takes hours to download on her side. What she's seen, she's loved. And when we first started thinking about doing this project, I told her that Marvel was interested in doing this, and she couldn't believe that the people behind Spider-Man, which she loves...
She reads Spider-Man.
She loves Spider-Man, so she couldn't believe that the people behind Spider-Man knew who she was, were interested in her story, and wanted to give her the same treatment they gave to Spider-Man.
Yeah, well, Madaya Mom, whoever she is nothing short of heroic. Reem Momtaz, the co-creator of Madaya Mom, a new digital comic by ABC News and Marvel Comics. Thanks very much for telling us about this.
Thank you.
You are with The World. Hurricane Matthew is impacting the presidential race. Today, the Trump campaign scrapped a planned fundraiser in Florida that was to feature the candidate's daughter, Ivanka, and the Clinton campaign pulled some ads that were due to air in Florida over the next few days. Voters in Florida are not focused on politics right now as the storm approaches. We'll have more on Hurricane Matthew and the damage it's already caused in Haiti in just a few minutes. One of the big issues this election, and perhaps every election, is immigration, and we've heard from many sides on the immigration debate here on the show. Today we're going to hear from people who rely heavily on immigrant labor, American farmers. The World's Jason Margolis has our story from North Carolina.
And this is a story you've probably heard before. In fact, you may have heard nearly this exact same story. I spoke with North Carolina sweet potato farmer Johnny Barnes 9 years ago about the U.S. immigration system. He was facing a challenge many farmers were facing. Perhaps 75% of farm workers in the U.S. were here illegally.
You know, we've got to deal with this in a realistic manner. We need the workers. The workers are only here because they're needed, because they want to work. And I get so sick and tired of people saying, well, they're not paying taxes. They're not pulling their weight. Every one of our employees, whether they're legal or illegal, I don't know which are legal and which are illegal, they pay their taxes. We take it out of their check every week. They're paying their way.
Back then, Barnes said he was relying mostly on Mexican workers, 650 during the harvest, because he couldn't get Americans to pick his crops.
They've got other opportunities, better conditions to work in. They don't want to work bent over, sweating in 90-degree temperatures out here in the field anymore.
Barnes was fed up because Congress narrowly failed to pass an immigration reform bill under President George W. Bush in 2006. In 2014, the same thing happened on President Obama's watch. I returned to Barnes's farm a few days ago and asked how he was feeling about things now.
Oh, we're very frustrated. We've been waiting a long time for something to be done as far as immigration reform.
Barnes seemed, simply put, deflated.
Well, it's just a lot of the candidates are demagoguing the issue. They're smart people. They know better. They know a lot of things are not going to happen if we don't have the workers here to do it. But they have found a whipping boy, and they're playing it up, or they're trying to legalize everybody so they can vote for them.
Barnes relies heavily on what's called the H-2A visa. It allows him to temporarily bring foreign workers to his farm to hand-pick his sweet potatoes. First, he has to advertise locally for Americans, though. If he can't find enough, and he never does, he turns to Mexico.
I mean, it cost me $1,000 per person to get them here for all the visas, the costs and all, and they have to turn around and go right back. I mean, it's very expensive. It's very bureaucratic.
And if Barnes's workers show up a few weeks late, his crops can die on the vine. I hear this from farmer after farmer criticizing the H-2A visa program. So does Edward Alden at the Council on Foreign Relations.
The biggest problem for the farmers is the annual requirement that they demonstrate that they have gone out and tried to hire American workers for these jobs and failed to do so. So they feel like they have to go through this charade every year.
Then, having done that, farm owners need to recruit a largely new workforce each season. Alden doesn't see any prospect of relief coming from Washington anytime soon. That's been doubly frustrating for farmers because their problems seem so solvable.
There's a bill that's been introduced in the Congress over the last decade called the Ag Jobs Program, which has the support of the farmers, has support of the unions representing farm workers. It would pass easily through the Congress.
Ag jobs would address labor shortages, protect workers' rights, and offer a path to legal status for the undocumented farm workers. But here's the problem: politics. Ag jobs has been bundled into larger immigration bills. If ag jobs were to pass on its own, there would be even less chance of passing the more contentious elements of immigration reform.
Jason, I compared it, I probably told you 9 years ago, the same thing. It's like a three-legged stool.
That's Larry Wooten, president of the North Carolina Farm Bureau. We also met nearly a decade ago and had a very similar conversation. He says the first leg of the stool is border security.
We all agree on that. You know, Democrats, Republicans, liberals, we all know who's in the country. We all have border security.
The second leg is better work visas.
Not only for our agricultural workers, but also for our high-tech folks. This idea, particularly in agriculture, of these folks are coming taking American jobs in agriculture, that's horse feathers.
So, two sturdy legs of the stool. But here's why the stool ultimately topples over.
Where we run in the ditch on this issue of immigration, where we just, it's what do you do with the 18, 12, 20 million undocumented folks that are here?
Nobody knows exactly how many undocumented people are in the U.S., but it's generally agreed that it's around 11 or 12 million. Back on his farm, Johnny Barnes said it's high time to repair the third leg of the stool.
We can't round all 11 or 12 million of them up and ship them back to Mexico. I mean, it'd be a civil war. I mean, you look at the families that have been created. A lot of these workers, they've bought property. They own their own home. They own cars. You know, they're paying their taxes. They're part of our social fabric now, and we've got to recognize that.
By the way, that was Barnes speaking nearly a decade ago. For The World, Jason Margolis, Spring Hope, North Carolina.
We'll be talking a lot more about all this tomorrow in a special edition of the show coming to you from Phoenix, Arizona. We were there this week to speak with Latino voters about the issues that matter to them. And yes, immigration has long been on that list.
For 20 years, I've been begging Republicans and Democrats to fix this issue for 20 years. And we have been building political power. This is the only first time that we didn't have to go and force the political candidates to start talking about immigration because of the way that Donald Trump is bringing this up.
This man came to the U.S. illegally but found a path to citizenship as a result of an immigration reform bill passed in 1986 during the Reagan administration. He's voting Democrat this fall.
I know the feeling of living under the shadows, and I also know the satisfaction that you leave when you come out of the shadows and start contributing to this country that you call your own country.
But immigration is just one of many issues of interest to Latino voters in Arizona. This woman spoke about values. She's a Trump supporter.
We need to preserve our Constitution, and the United States, I still believe, is the greatest country in the world. And as Republicans, you know, and I still think most Latinos, they are Republicans, they just don't know it, they're conservative, because we are pro-familia, pro-life, and we're very self-reliant.
Latino men and women, liberals and conservatives, with strong feelings about whose vision should lead this country. I learned a lot this week in Arizona. Join me tomorrow when we examine why Latinos are voting in a special edition of The World. Coming up, a test of loyalties for a Muslim doctor in Chicago. You know, he's always been partial to the White Sox, but it's the Cubs with the best record in baseball.
They last won the World Series 108 years ago. Teddy Roosevelt was still president at that time. And now the Cubs may win it all. There's hysteria throughout the city. People, pets, and buildings are all draped in Cubby blue.
One man's dilemma, that's still ahead, here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. The showy bat flip is a major league no-no. It's likely to get a batter beaned during the next at-bat. But in Korea?
It happens so often there that if pitchers were to drill batters after they do it, you'd kind of take out the whole team.
The art of the Korean bat flip, that's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. If you're listening to us in Florida or you're on the path of Hurricane Matthew, we're thinking of you. President Obama today declared a state of emergency in Florida. The storm is headed for the state's east coast, and millions of people from Florida up to South Carolina could be impacted by what may be catastrophic damage. Haiti has already felt the force of Hurricane Matthew. Authorities there said more than 100 people were killed, and they're reporting heavy flooding and wind damage, especially in the south of Haiti. Christy Delafield is with the aid organization Mercy Corps in the capital, Port-au-Prince.
We're seeing quite a lot of flooding. Of course, as you said, the south has just been the hardest hit. One of the things that's concerning is how difficult it is to access these areas. There's a bridge that goes down into what we call the Southern Claw that's been washed out. So we're looking at trying to get teams down there in other ways. But we still only know sort of a fraction of the impact of the damage.
Where have your teams been able to get to across Haiti?
So we have been around Port-au-Prince, the area that is the largest banana growing area. It's been severely hit. About 80% of that banana growing area, that those fields have been destroyed. And not just by the high winds, but also by the flooding. Mm. And because it's seawater, I mean, their fields have been literally salted. So it remains to be seen what recovery will look like in that area, because replanting in that earth may be challenging.
What does this do to the Haitian economy?
We're really concerned. I mean, obviously, a lot of people, the majority of the population, are subsistence farmers. About 20,000 people, families, work in that region. And then when you look beyond the people that work on those farms, you start to think about the carry-on implications for the rest of the economy. One of the things that Mercy Corps is doing is kind of looking at the watershed as a whole, working with farmers up in the mountains to try to prevent more erosion from happening. And we'll be rolling out some financial assistance to subsistence farmers that, you know, may have lost their crops this year or may have lost their livelihoods.
What about the human factor here? How many families do you know that have lost their homes?
I mean, that's the scary thing, right? We still don't know the full number of people who have lost their homes. We're going to continue to get more information over the coming days. But anecdotally, the stories I'm hearing are the roof just blew off. I can't even imagine how terrifying that must be to be, you know, sitting in these hurricane force winds with the pouring rain and just have the roof of your home, which in most cases is made out of like a corrugated metal, just go flying off.
Well, I mean, the 2010 earthquake devastated Haiti. And I know even 6 years later, a lot of people are still in tents and damaged homes. Did you get a sense how much Hurricane Matthew has taken that slow grinding problem and just made it worse?
It's really a setback for all of the development gains that we've made. And certainly the issue of clean water is something that emerged as a challenge after the hurricane. This year has been a bad year for cholera. And if you even start to think beyond that to other waterborne illnesses like Zika, we really need to be thinking about how can we repair this infrastructure.
Yeah. So what's the first step right now? I mean, you've got to get clean drinking water to people, right?
Absolutely. I mean, in this particular moment, in the just a few days afterwards, we're talking to people about whether they have enough food to eat, whether they have a place to sleep tonight, whether they have clean drinking water for today. And then we start looking at how do we build a stronger tomorrow? How do we come together with the farmers associations, the local groups, and other aid associations to coordinate and determine who is best placed where to try to rebuild? And that may take a variety of forms. It may be, you know, a voucher system, or it might be we give out cash directly. But the urgent and immediate problem is clean water today.
How much are you concerned by, well, the hurricane's moved on and maybe it's not that urgent, even though there are problems that are many, many years old?
I mean, I think that's the heartbreaking thing for me, honestly, and for the Haitian people. You look at this devastation, and obviously there's a lot of media attention in the immediate moment, video footage of horrific high winds. And we're really grateful that so far we haven't heard reports of a very high death toll, but you know, we see the storm moving on. We see the attention moving on. Of course, thinking about people in Florida, thinking about people in the Bahamas, in Cuba, and hoping that they are safe and well as the storm moves through. But here in Haiti, we're just looking at how do we get the attention to rebuild, to take care of people in the immediate. There are going to be some serious financial needs, and we're going to stick around and see what we can do to help people out.
Christy Delafield with Mercy Corps in Haiti, speaking with us from Port-au-Prince. Thanks very much, Christy, for your time.
Thank you.
We're going to hear now about a community struggling with a serious drug abuse problem. A lot of places here in the U.S. would sadly fit that description, but I'm talking about a town in Ukraine called Boryspil. It's a suburb near the capital, Kiev. Unemployment is high there. And as I said, they've got a lot of drug problems. Police officers in Boryspil spend as much as 40% of their time dealing with drug-related issues. Ukraine as a whole has one of the fastest-growing HIV-AIDS epidemics in the world. One of the main reasons is intravenous drug use. In Boryspil, there is a program that's trying to help solve this problem. It involves social workers working together with the police. Photographer Misha Friedman recently spent some time with police in Boryspil and was able to see the drug problem up close. So you went on a ride with police in Boryspil, Misha. What do the police deal with every day? What did you see?
They deal with a disproportionate amount of basically drug use. For a town of only 60,000 people, I saw at least half a dozen different like dens and places in public parks and behind garages where it's not just kids, it's not just kind of vagabonds and whatnot. It's regular people before going to work, leaving their apartments, going behind the garage, shooting up, and then heading off to Kiev, to their place of work.
To be clear, Misha, we're not talking about eastern Ukraine where a war is simmering away. Boryspil is in the west of the country, as you said, a commuting city to Kiev. Do you find the problems in Boryspil in other parts of Ukraine, even around Kiev?
Very much so. Despite its proximity to Kiev, the problems in Boryspil are very representative of all of Ukraine. And it's incredible that it's so close to the capital. The problems do exist in the capital itself, of course, but, you know, it's a city of over 3 million people, so it's a lot more spread out.
What would you say is a typical police mentality in dealing with addicts, and how has this program where social workers are joining the police kind of changing that mentality?
2 years ago, after the Maidan Revolution, one of the first reforms to begin and to really, one of the first reforms to actually work in Ukraine was the police reform. This new police in Boryspil, I don't believe they beat people up. They don't extort. They don't go back to the practices of the people they replaced. However, they view drug users strictly through the criminal and administrative penal codes, which in Eastern Europe still they operate on the basis that drug users are first and foremost criminals because drugs are illegal. Therefore, if you're in the possession of a drug, you are a criminal. While a more modern Western European, North American approach is that drug users are first patients. They're sick.
I understand there's a local NGO that started working with the police and kind of trying to change the mentality that they should look at drug addiction as an illness, not a crime. What were these training sessions like? Because I know you went to one of them.
The goal is to improve Brisbane, is to make this town a safer place, not just for drug users, but for regular citizens, obviously. The feeling among social workers was that they really need to understand kind of the modern views on pharmacology, on HIV, on some basic harm reduction techniques that have, like needle exchange, like substitution therapy with methadone, that the policemen had no idea or had very limited knowledge about, is to explain all these services and if they awareness of these services and perhaps if some of the services are absent in Brisbane, police are powerful enough where they can lobby the mayor of Brisbane to install these services in Brisbane. That could have a chain reaction.
So do you think what's happening in Brisbane is in fact changing the mentality of the police, and could it be duplicated in other cities and towns around Ukraine?
I hope so. It's too early to say if the both mentality and actual steps will be taken, because I think it will require much more than one or two sessions with dozens of police officers. I see that there is interest on both sides, and aid workers discovered some things in Brisbane that they will investigate, and I hope the word will spread in Brisbane's police department and to our towns that there's this thing going on and it actually works.
Photographer Misha Friedman, thank you.
Thank you.
Check out Misha Friedman's photo essay from Brisbane. That's at PRI.org. After the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, a lot of things changed in all the former Soviet republics, including Russia. For one thing, Russians began a new love affair with coffee, and one of the people who brought gourmet brew to Russia was an American entrepreneur. He started what became one of the largest coffee chains in Russia, but then he moved back to the U.S. to start over. Alina Simone has more.
Sitting at a table under the awning of a shopping plaza in Rohnert Park, California, Chris Tara Brown is holding a business meeting.
So when do we want to start serving the tacos, you think?
Okay, you'll return Monday in the morning?
No, I return Sunday. I'll be back.
Chris and his assistant manager, Pablo Cesarte, are discussing plans for his new venture, Unity Cafe, where he plans to sell third-wave coffee, artisanal sandwiches, and killer tacos. But right now, the modest hot dog stand facing the parking lot still bears its old name.
Chuckles Hot Dog Stand, man. Chuckles Snack Shack, I think is what it's called.
The last time I met Tara Brown was 10 years ago, under very different circumstances. We were in the middle of Siberia, and I was a customer at his popular cafe, Traveler's Coffee. See, Tara Brown is a California native, but he's a coffee king in Russia. He opened his first coffee shop in Novosibirsk back in 2000. Within 15 years, Travelers had become a chain with more than 100 branches, stretching from Ukraine to China. For coffee addicts in Russia, or expats like me, Travelers was a godsend.
The coffee situation was brutal. It was two scoops of, you know, Pele or Nescafe.
Tara Brown didn't know anyone when he came to Siberia. He didn't even speak Russian. He took the trip on a whim. It was 1994, a little over 2 years after the Soviet Union dissolved, and Chris was 25, a struggling music producer.
As I was on this Trans-Siberian train, I was like, this is where I want to be. This is it.
Chris ended up meeting a Russian woman, getting married, and finding work with another American who opened Siberia's first pizza parlor. Then one day, Chris walked into an Irish pub in downtown Novosibirsk and ordered a cappuccino.
And it started going, and it spat out this black liquid. And I was like, oh, that sucks, you know. And it was just one of those moments. 3 steps out of this place, I'm like, coffee house. And it was at that point I was possessed.
To most people, bringing gourmet coffee to Siberia sounded like business suicide. The year he started, the average salary hovered around $400 a month. And at $3 each, a cappuccino was a luxury. But Tara Brown saw a Russian public hungry for international goods.
I go, would you like to have a great cappuccino? I don't even know what a cappuccino is. I don't even know what that is. Sounds great. It sounds Italian, you know? And so it was just amazing.
Business took off, but between Russia's volatile economy and Siberia's brutal climate, it wasn't always easy. Chris recalls one winter when his first 10 stores were almost out of beans.
When I'm talking to our roast masters, and he goes, there's no coffee. Well, what do you mean there's no coffee? And he's like, we can't take the container off the train. I'm like, what are you talking about? The cranes don't work in minus 40 degrees. They'll break. The cranes will literally break in minus 40 degrees. And I'm like, ah! I'm just absolutely, I'm losing it.
By 2015, Tara Brown had created one of the largest coffee chains in Russia and turned Novosibirsk into a version of Seattle with its own roastery and barista school. So why did he leave?
I was just tired. I was like, oh my God, not another crisis.
But Tara Brown concedes there were some internal issues as well.
A former partner of mine got in his mind that he needed the assets more than we did and started forging documents and doing a bunch of really insane things. And, he's striving to take over the company.
Chris insists his departure wasn't a case of politics Russia style, a polarizing Western businessman being pushed out in favor of native talent. He says he was already planning to come home. Nonetheless, it's been an adjustment.
Yeah, I had some clout, you know. People knew me, and it was kind of a cool thing. It was kind of a rock star.
Here, he's a bit of a coffee Rip Van Winkle. After all, San Francisco has also changed a lot in the past 21 years. Today, it's an epicenter of the artisanal coffee movement, a scene Chris feels is due for a correction.
The coffee movement has gotten way too foofy, hipster. If you don't know what the Yirgacheff Amaro Gayo, you know, direct lot is, then you're out. It's like, you shouldn't be ordering here. Get out of here.
That snooty vibe won't be a problem here at the mall in Rohnert Park. If there's one thing he's bringing back home, it's Russian hospitality. For The World, this is Alina Simone from Rohnert Park, California.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. It is postseason baseball time, and we're pretty stoked here in Boston because the Red Sox are in it this year. This is also the last postseason for Red Sox slugger David Ortiz. Our much-loved Big Poppy is about to retire. But here's something some baseball fans don't love about Ortiz. After an especially big hit, he's been known to throw his bat in the air, you know, flipping it. Baseball purists don't like bat flips. They say they're an insult to the pitcher, the opposing team, and all that's sacred in America's pastime. That's how ESPN's Mina Kimes sums up the disdain for bat flips here in the U.S. But there is an alternate bat-flipping universe in South Korea, and Kimes was there recently. I asked her what it was like to see a bat flip there.
Well, it wasn't just one, Marco. I saw many, many bat flips. And I think that was what was so initially astonishing for me when I went to my first game. You know, I was like, oh, I really hope I see one, maybe a home run. And they just started pouring like a gusher of bat flips. And gradually I learned from going to a few games is that this is a pretty common occurrence.
So are you saying like every batter in the lineup is going to flip their bat if they get a hit?
Not every batter. I think I probably saw an average about 5 or 6 per game at least. And so what I started to hear was, you know, it's just when you get a really good, solid hit, you know, you really get that kind of good smack that mm-hmm. makes the batter want to flip their bat.
So what's the reaction to it from the crowd?
Well, you don't really notice it in the crowd because, you know, when you're in the stadium, you're watching the ball. And they don't play replays on a big screen, I think, in most of the stadiums there. So you don't really notice it sometimes. A few times I think they were pretty flamboyant or the bats flew far enough to where I think some fans kind of noticed it or there was enough of a gap. But it often happens pretty quickly.
What about the other team when they see the batter do a flip?
They do not care.
They don't care.
So it's not like in the U.S. where they do care a lot. And, you know, there's the whole code and there's retribution for flipping your bat as an insult to the pitcher. There's really no reaction. I think the pitchers are just inert to it. They're so used to it happening all the time.
is it just frequency? You think that's it? I mean, why are they so cool with it? While here in the States, we're against it, mostly.
Yeah. Well, this was kind of the big question driving my story. You know, at first I wanted to figure out who did this first, how did it start, how did it become a thing? But then gradually I was kind of like, well, why do they not care here? And I came with a few reasons. One was that the player who did it first in Korea was a slugger named Yang Jun-hyuk, who's sort of a legend in the KBO, one of the greatest hitters of all time. So he did it first, and you know, other players were kind of like, oh, okay, well, hey, if Yang Jun-hyuk does it, right, I guess it's okay, I guess it's cool. But the other thing is, you know, it happens so often there that if pitchers were to drill batters after they do it, you'd kind of take out the whole team. And then the other thing I think is that, you know, there's less of a culture of retribution in Korean baseball. All the players know each other. They all went to school together. So there's not just retribution against bat flips. There's no retribution in general. There aren't that many fights. There's no takeout slides. It's just a totally different baseball culture.
Yeah, Mina, have you ever found this acceptance of bat flipping anywhere else in the world, like Japan or Cuba?
Definitely. You know, in Latin America, I think there's more acceptance for bat flips and celebrations and just kind of a raucous baseball culture in general. You know, the U.S. kind of stands alone, I think, in its punitive culture, and sort of the unwritten rules are pretty much restricted to America.
Right. So as far as the Korean ballplayers bat flips, they're distinct, right? I mean, each hitter has his own version and style.
Definitely. A lot of it is tied to how they swing their bats. You know, if they have more of an uppercut swing, or in the case of Choi Jin-suk, who's one of the greatest bat flippers in the KBO, it's how his bat sort of bounces off of his shoulder and there's a little bit of a ricochet effect. So he really sends it flying. And they all have different sort of velocities and sort of styles to how they flip their bats. It's kind of fun to watch.
So now that you're back home, the playoffs are happening. Are you hoping for some righteous bat
flips
this postseason?
Oh my gosh, of course. When Bautista had a home run in the wild card game, I was like, flip your bat, flip your bat, flip your bat. He didn't do it. I think he might be saving it for later on. You know, he's the sort of most iconic bat flipper in MLB right now, but I'll definitely have my eye out for that.
Is the postseason here kind of the super unsafe harbor for bat flips?
I think that when the stakes are raised in a game, the players at least say that they're more accepting of it. However, you know, when Bautista flipped his bat, it kicked off this huge firestorm and all the Rangers complained about it. So I guess that kind of went out the window. That was a particularly, as you might remember, tantalizing, taunting bat flip. And he kind of, you know, he stared down the pitcher a little bit first, which I think it maybe exacerbated it a bit.
Right.
But I don't know. Fans love it, man. I mean, I just really hope we get to see at least one.
ESPN's Mina Kimes, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Who knows? Maybe that one bat flip in the playoffs will come from David Ortiz. I'm sure Red Sox fans here in Boston wouldn't mind for one or more. Postseason baseball often brings heartache for fans in Chicago. That's only half true this year. The White Sox are out, but the Chicago Cubs are in with the best record in baseball, no less. And expectations are quite sizable, says our friend Jalal Baig. He's a physician based in Chicago.
The Cubs have long been baseball's lovable losers. They last won the World Series 108 years ago. Teddy Roosevelt was still president at that time. And now the Cubs may win it all. There's hysteria throughout the city. People, pets, and buildings are all draped in Cubby blue. But I'm having commitment issues. You see, I'm a passionate White Sox fan. It has been this way since I attended my first baseball game at Comiskey Park when I was 8 years old. Despite the team's average success over the years, my allegiance to their team has remained steadfast. But now with the Cubs poised to do big things in the playoffs, I'm starting to reconsider. Suddenly, I'm having this dilemma about staying loyal to the White Sox. We are all grappling with similar quandaries at this time. Some are more apparent than others, given the polarization and division in our world. To eat gluten or remain gluten-free? Support Colin Kaepernick's decision to protest or condemn it? Embrace refugees or close our borders? And most importantly, who to vote for in this upcoming election? Trump, Clinton, or third party? In the end, a person can only hope to make a just decision consistent with his or her deepest convictions. And so, I think I've made my choice. Hope is eternal. I will avoid the bandwagon and remain a White Sox fan.
That was Chicago-based physician Jalal Baig. The Cubs play against the Giants tomorrow night. Before you catch that game, though, be sure to join us right here for a special edition of The World tomorrow. We'll be focusing entirely on issues that are important to Latino voters in a key state this presidential election, Arizona. Our special show from Phoenix, from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being here.
PRI. Public Radio International.